Hi, this is Kevin Fong. And before you get to the podcast you've downloaded, I just wanted to tell you about 13 Minutes to the Moon, which is available now. It's the definitive story of the Apollo moon landings as told to me by some of the people who made it happen. That's 13 Minutes to the Moon, a new podcast from the BBC World Service. And I'll be back a little later to tell you more about it.
I'm Justin Rowlett, and I've come to one of the world's great rivers, the Thames, for today's Business Daily. That's because today's programme is all about the risk of flooding and why we don't take it seriously enough.
I mean, I think that it will take a big storm that hits a really big metropolitan area and causes really severe damage.
Sea level is rising, and that's why I'm working right now to address the problems of climate change.
Shanghai, Mumbai, Jakarta, Boston's threat in the United States is very much underappreciated.
So beware, the waters are rising, and you need to take action now if you're going to avoid a soaking, both real and financial. That is Business Daily. Here on the BBC World Service. We all know the story of King Canute, who showed his sycophantic advisers how ridiculous they were to claim he could hold back the tides. But perhaps they had a point. Listen to this. That is the sound of human ingenuity made real. The sound of the Thames's great tidal barrier going down. Steve East is in charge of the day-to-day operation of the barrier for the company that runs it, Thames Tidal Defences. So, Steve,
it's a special day today, isn't it?
It is.
35th anniversary to the day of the Queen coming down here.
Indeed, yeah? And I understand, looking at the old footage of the event, that the weather was just like this as well.
Raining.
Cold, wet and windy.
We're looking across at the barrier now. Describe what we're seeing.
Well, the barrier is a simple tool in as much as it puts a wall of steel right across the river. So when the gates are open, shipping can still go through the Thames barrier.
And the gates are curved, we should say.
They are, and that helps to share the load, because you can imagine the pressures pressing against those gates is immense. Even though those gates weigh 3,300 tonnes each.
Each.
Which is the equivalent of about 6.5 fully laden super jumbo jets. So we're moving a lot of heavy equipment in a tidal range of 7 metres.
So what is the purpose of this?
Well, the purpose is to stop threat of tidal flooding in central London. So when a combination of factors arise, a high astronomic tide, perhaps a high downstream flow in the river, plus a surge element, which is caused by weather conditions, those tides are the dangerous ones. They would overtop the wall defences in central London and flood the city.
So this is a useful barrier.
It is, and it's going to continue to be useful for many years to come.
Tell me about the pattern of closures. Has that changed over the years?
Well, it was always expected that the number of closures would increase over the years, and we're seeing that, but it's not a linear increase. Some flood seasons, we haven't had any closures at all. A few years ago, because of rainfall, a bit like today, then we closed on 50 occasions in a three-month period. And once we start to have 50 closures a year on a regular basis, that's when we'll need to consider things such as Thames Barrier 2.
So you're already planning Thames Barrier 2?
We are. It'll be many, many years in the future. I won't be around to see it, but I'm sure at some point there will be a second Thames Barrier.
Thank you, Steve East. Well, climate change is, of course, a global problem, and London, just one coastal city grappling with the consequences of rising sea levels. So what is the scale of the challenge? Ben Strauss is the head and chief scientist at Climate Central, a group of climatologists and journalists based in New York who are seeking to raise public awareness about the facts of climate change.
Sea level rise is both one of the most serious threats we face from climate, and it's also one that is very easy to pinpoint. What cities and neighbourhoods face a risk.
What kind of sea level rise do you think we can expect by the end of this century?
Most of the models tell us that it will be somewhere near 1 metre, depending on whether we can cut our emissions. 1 meter is enough to make some of the world's great low-lying cities almost uninhabitable. Mumbai, Jakarta, Ho Chi Minh City, Shanghai is in an extremely vulnerable position. It's the number one city in the world with the most people living on vulnerable land. London gets into real trouble eventually. Boston's threat in the United States is very much underappreciated. It's quite a range of cities all around the world, but especially in Asia. And the other thing to remember is we're not talking about just sea level rise, but sea level rise raising the launch pad for storms.
So you're talking about big storms, which can bring with them obviously lots of wind and water. You can get big tidal surges, that kind of thing, which obviously are all accentuated if you have higher sea level.
Yes, and a few things are making tropical storms more dangerous today. Climate change has heated up the oceans, and ocean heat is the fuel that powers the strength of tropical storms. And a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture, which can lead to much more torrential rainfall. Finally, one thing we're seeing in parts of the northern hemisphere, at least, is a jet stream that has become much wavier. You can have deep troughs of low pressure or high pressure that can hold major storms in place for longer, just like we saw, for example, with Hurricane Harvey in Texas.
When are we likely to see the first really catastrophic inundation?
Well, I think we already have seen catastrophic inundation. Hurricane Katrina illustrates what happens when your city is below sea level, which New Orleans already is. And we're going to see more and more places living below sea level in the future because as sea levels rise, many cities will respond by building walls and levees. That's quite sensible, but it puts us at much greater danger of catastrophic risk. If there is a storm big enough to overtop your defenses, then the bowl that your city is sitting in the bottom of fills up very quickly with water. So it poses a less frequent but more severe threat.
Now listen, so far we've only talked up to 2100, to the end of the century, but obviously we should all be concerned about what happens after that as well. Have you forecasted beyond the turn of the next century?
Yes, we have, and ironically, it's easier to forecast in the long run than it is to forecast in the short run. We can look back over hundreds of thousands of years, and we find that sea level is extremely sensitive to small changes in temperature. We expect more than 2 meters of sea level rise per 1 degree of warming. So that tells me that we can expect more than 2 meters of sea level rise, even if we stopped emitting tomorrow. That's a much graver threat. There's absolutely no way that South Florida, for example, continues to exist in that world. There's no way that much of coastal Bangladesh survives in that world. I heard a leading scientist from the Netherlands tell me that 1 meter of sea level rise is a really interesting problem. How do they engineer and protect the Netherlands? But, he said, 2 meters is not very interesting. The only person who should be interested in 2 meters of sea level rise is the prime minister, who has to go and knock on Germany's door and ask whether there's room.
I mean, what about Shanghai? Has it gone?
I think in these farther futures, Shanghai is gone without major marvels of engineering.
Be afraid, people of Shanghai and the world, says climatologist Ben Strauss. But we don't seem to be very frightened, at least if you look at property prices. Climate risk barely features in most appraisals of property values, according to the real estate investment company Heitman. The company owns and manages more than $40 billion worth of property worldwide on behalf of pension funds and other long-term investors, and they are worried about climate risk. Brian Klinksick is their Director of Strategy and Research Operations here in London.
If you think about the world's great cities and where the real estate value is, it tends to be located in places close to the sea. That's not surprising because the world's great cities historically grew up around harbors. So we did an analysis in the U.S. that shows that 24% of the real estate stock tracked by one of the indices of investable real estate is in the 10% of cities that are most exposed to climate change.
Right, let me ask you this. If you look around the world, which cities should we worry about most?
You know, I think one of the most important points to make is that we are not going to have a world where we allow Lower Manhattan to become flooded and unusable. You have tens of billions of dollars worth of real estate, and you need to spend billions to defend it. But if you talk about a low-density coastal community, like some of the coastal areas of Florida, the question is, would you spend billions to defend millions? And you wouldn't. And so I think the places are at risk that don't have the density and value to make those kinds of improvements worthwhile.
So having identified the cities at risk, there's another whole layer of analysis, which is about what kind of responses are possible and then how effective those responses are likely to be.
That's absolutely right. So one of the things that you have to evaluate is, what are the costs of protecting places and who will bear those costs?
Right. So we're going to build a massive flood wall around Manhattan. And your question is it you, the property owner, who clearly gets a huge benefit if a flood wall is built? Are they going to charge you? And I would say, frankly, they probably are. It makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it could be central governments. It could be more like state and local governments, or it could be a more direct levy on the property owner themselves.
To what extent are property prices beginning to reflect these risks?
That's a great question. The impact on property prices is beginning to show up. The most compelling studies were done in the South Florida residential market, where there's beginning to be a divergence between the lower-lying places and other parts of the market.
So you are beginning to see that price difference.
But only in these very egghead statistical models. The individual homeowner or property investor, your property is appreciated by 30%, mostly because of what's happening to interest rates. Then you don't notice that it would have increased by 35% had it not been in this climate risk exposed location.
So it's kind of noise in the system at the moment, but it is an existential threat in that the entire value of the property could be destroyed. You would expect a risk as fundamental as this to be priced in pretty soon. Are you saying that isn't happening at the moment?
It's not being priced in very much. In some cases, not at all. When we first presented to an audience of big property investors, big sophisticated institutional investors, and one of the first questions was, you know what, if I price this into my deals, I might as well stop investing.
This sounds to me a little bit like the beginning of the financial crisis when people said, oh, you know, it just simply can't be that bad and went on investing. When do you think the market will begin to accurately reflect climate risk? Is there going to be a moment suddenly when the markets go, oh my God, is that the real value of our investments?
I mean, I think that it will take a big event like a storm that hits a really big metropolitan area and causes really severe damage.
So you're saying when it hits New York, suddenly we'll all go, oh my, is that the real risk?
I mean, I think it'll take an event like that for this to really be priced in more broadly.
How long do you think it's going to be until such an event happens, till we wake up?
I think we got really close at a couple of instances recently. So I think it's going to be sooner rather than later. I think it's going to be the next few years, actually.
So the moment of reckoning is coming, says Brian Klinksick. He believes it will prompt many cities to up the pace of their investment in flood defences. That is already happening in Shanghai, says Chang Qi. She's a Chinese national and a researcher at Delft University in the Netherlands, a major academic centre for flood defence engineering. She's been commissioned by the Shanghai city authorities to assess the scale of the problems posed by climate change in the near future.
Actually, the Shanghai government already take some actions. They are trying to strengthen and enforce the sea walls and flood walls along the river and started for like 10 years construction of the storm surge barrier to the mouth of the Huangpu River. They're also thinking about to do some deep tunnel, which can also store excess stormwater.
But looking ahead 100 years, all of these problems are likely to be accelerated. Higher sea levels, more rainfall, bigger storm surges. I mean, the problem's going to get worse and worse. Can you really engineer your way out of this?
Yeah, that's true. That's why I'm working right now, that is to address the problems in the future. Sea level is rising, and to address the flood defense system, height or strength, around Shanghai, especially the sea dikes and the flood wall along the river.
But sea dikes and sea walls,
If you go on building them up, surely you run the risk that if there is a failure, it's going to be a complete catastrophe. The higher the walls, the more water it's holding back. If the walls break, you flood the entire city. There could be hundreds of thousands, millions of people could die, surely.
Yeah, exactly. That's true.
I mean, does there come a point where you say the investment needed to give the kind of safety that Shanghai needs simply isn't worth it? We're going to have to abandon the city.
Abandon the city. No, I don't think so. It's because this sea level rising is a common problem for all the coastal cities in the world as well. Shanghai can learn something from the Netherlands, especially on the flood defense system. They are using dike rings in the inland area, which can provide us the secondary flood defense system for the cities.
Chang Ki there. Well, back here in London, I'm joined by Kanta Mocha, who is the flood and coastal risk manager for London for the UK's Environment Agency. And Kanta, you also penned a report into how London can respond to rising sea levels and climate change, didn't you? So how can we respond?
We have a staged approach where we will have to build first increased walls in the outer estuary. We will then need to think about increasing the wall heights in the inside estuary, so the London part. And then finally, we'll need to think about a replacement barrier. We know that will be around 2070 based on current sea level rise. But obviously, if things accelerate, it'll need to be earlier. But at the same time, we're working with all the local government along the stretch of river to think about what riverside needs to look like in the future. Do we want riverbanks that are just walls?
So you were saying building barriers further away from the river. So there are areas that might occasionally flood, but otherwise can be useful.
Yeah, so this is one thing. So in the outer estuary, for example, we are thinking about retreating in some areas because there's not the people, there's not the property there.
So some places you'll retreat, other places you'll defend. How confident are you that you can defend London over the next two centuries?
So I think we're very confident we can defend them over the next century. Over the next two centuries, that's a long time. You know, I'd be a foolish man to commit to say that. But we protect London at the moment from a 1-in-1,000-year event. What would happen is if we didn't do anything, that standard protection would drop over time.
But there is an issue here, isn't there? Because as sea level rises, you build your defences up. If it does breach, it's going to be an even more catastrophic flood, isn't it?
Yes, if it does breach, it will be a more catastrophic flood. That's why the reliability of the barrier in particular is so important. And that's why we spend so much money. That's why Steve is testing the barrier today, so we have absolute certainty that when we need to close it, it does close.
Thank you, Mr. Mocha. And that's where we'll be ending the programme. But Business Daily will continue to report climate change and what we can all do to tackle it. So keep on listening.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
A story of breathtaking ambition.
I thought that he was a little premature on making an announcement just in 10 years since we hadn't even gone into orbit.
A story of incredible innovation.
I'm in charge of this stuff called software. But nobody knew what software was.
A story of amazing human endeavor.
It was the lack of fear. It wasn't the lack of knowing it was risky, but just weren't afraid of it.
A story of triumph over adversity.
As they pitch over and see the moon for the first time, Neil said, "We can't land here."
A story where we all know the ending.
It's one small step for man.
But not necessarily the beginning. I'm Kevin Fong, and 50 years on, I'll be telling the story of the Apollo moon landings in a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service.
We're about to do something that nobody's ever done.
With the help of the people who made it happen.
We were able to do this impossible thing.
That's 13 Minutes to the Moon.
We did it. We did it.
The first episode is available now. Just search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you found this podcast.
The Eagle has landed.